Welcome back to Science TLDR. We're the podcast that digs into complex science for, well, for experts like you.
That's right.
Today, we're doing a deep dive into a really fascinating paper from the New England Journal of Medicine. It's titled, Patient-Specific In Vivo Gene Editing to Treat a Rare Genetic Disease.
It's quite something. The paper lays out this incredibly fast development and the first use, really, of a custom-made base editing therapy.
And for a neonate, an infant with a severe condition, carbamoyl phosphate synthetase 1 deficiency. CPS1 deficiency.
Exactly, CPS1 deficiency. It's typically lethal, an ultra-rare metabolic disorder.
Hmm.
What's documented here is, frankly, a potential game-changer for how we might approach these urgent genetic diagnoses.
Maybe just a quick refresher for everyone on CPS1. It's a key enzyme, mitochondrial, mostly in the liver, right? Kicks off the urea cycle.
That's the one. Its job is basically step one in getting rid of ammonia, which, mm-hmm. as you know, is a nasty neurotoxin from protein breakdown. It helps turn it into urea so we can excrete it.
So if CPS1 doesn't work?
Ammonia builds up. Hyperammonemia. And that can cause severe brain damage, often leading to death in infancy. It's really grim.
And it is ultra rare, you said.
Extremely rare, yes. Maybe 1 in 1.3 million births. About half of infants don't survive early infancy. That context really highlights why this study is so significant.
Absolutely. And the speed is just, wow, 6 months from diagnosis to treatment.
6 months. It's almost unheard of in therapeutic development, which usually takes years, sometimes decades.
That really underscores the big challenge with rare genetic diseases, doesn't it? Individually rare, but you add them all up.
And collectively, they affect a huge number of people worldwide. Hundreds of millions, potentially.
Yeah. But developing a unique drug for each one, especially ultra-rare ones, is just incredibly difficult and expensive.
Right. The traditional pharma model often struggles with that. The return on investment just isn't seen as being there for very small patient populations, leaving many without options.
Which is where things like N-of-1 therapies come in. Treatments made for just one person.
Precisely. And that's where technologies like gene editing, building on CRISPR-Cas9, and specifically base editing, like in this paper, hold so much promise.
Okay, so CRISPR-Cas9, most listeners will know it, molecular scissors, guided to a specific DNA spot. But base editing is different, more precise.
Yeah, think of it as a refinement. Instead of making that double-strand cut, which can sometimes cause unintended edits elsewhere, base editors chemically change one DNA letter to another, C to T or A to G.
Like a find and replace function for the genome, almost.
Exactly. A very precise molecular pencil, maybe, rather than scissors. In this case, they used an adenine base editor, an ADE, to fix a specific type of mutation.
Let's talk about the patient then. The symptoms started very early.
Very early. Lethargy, trouble breathing, within the first 48 hours after birth. Classic signs something was seriously wrong.
And the ammonia levels confirmed it.
Confirmed it dramatically.
Yeah.
Blood ammonia was over 1,000 micromoles per liter. The normal range is, what, below 35 or so?
So incredibly high.
Yep.
Okay. And the genetic diagnosis followed quickly.
Yes. Amino acid tests pointed towards the urea cycle problem, and then rapid genome analysis found two different mutations in the CPF1 gene, one from each parent compound heterozygous.
And what were the specific mutations?
Paternally inherited was C.103CUT, which creates a stop signal, Q335X. Maternally inherited was C.2140GT, another stop signal, E714X. Both basically stop the cell from making a working CPS1 enzyme.
Got it. Two non-functional copies. And the therapy targeted one of these.
It targeted the Q335X mutation on the paternal allele. The idea was to use adenine base editing to change that specific mutated A back to a G, fixing the code at that spot.
Right. Restoring the proper amino acid sequence. And this Q335X variant, it had been seen before, apparently.
It had, yes. Not common, certainly not in large databases, but it was documented in one other unrelated case that probably provided some useful prior information.
Okay, so diagnosis made, target identified, then came the therapy development itself, this K. How did they manage that so quickly?
They had a streamlined workflow ready. They couldn't easily get liver cells from the infant, obviously, so they used a standard liver cell line, UH87 cells, as a stand-in.
Makes sense. A proxy system.
Exactly. They put the patient's Q3335X mutation into these UH7 cells using a lentivirus. Now, they had a cell model mimicking the patient's defect.
And then screened different editing tools.
Right. They tested various adenine base editors and different guide RNAs to find the best combination for fixing the Q335X mutation efficiently and crucially specifically.
And they landed on one particular combination?
They did. An editor called NGC-ABEA-V106W paired with a specific guide RNA targeting that A at position 8 in the sequence.
Okay.
This pair gave the best results. They did note some minor bystander edits nearby, changing other adenines, but these were synonymous, meaning they didn't change the resulting amino acid.
So harmless side effects, essentially. And they gave it all a name.
Yes. The guide RNA was KJ Guran, the editor mRNA Abingsemeran, and the whole therapy package KAPE.
Catchy. Okay, so they have the tool. Next up, preclinical testing, I assume, before going near the patient.
Absolutely essential. First, in vitro tests on those engineered UH7 cells to figure out the dose needed, the EC50 and EC90, concentration for 50% and 90% editing.
Standard dose response work?
Correct. Then they moved into mice. They created a mouse model with the human Q335X variant inserted.
How did it work in the mice?
Pretty well. They saw corrective editing in up to 42% of liver cells, even at a low dose, 0.1 milligrams per kilogram. They also saw that synonymous bystander editing again, and they confirmed it in a second mouse model, too.
Encouraging efficacy. What about safety, particularly in something closer to humans?
Yes. They did a limited study in synalbicosis monkeys. A single IV dose, higher concentration, 1.5 millijoule a kilogram.
And the results?
No major signs of toxicity. They did see temporary increases in liver enzymes, ALT and AST, but that's often seen with lipid nanoparticle delivery systems, and it resolved.
Okay, that's somewhat expected then.
It is. And the lipid components cleared quickly, which is good news if you might need to redose later. Based on all this, they set the starting human dose at 0.1 millijoule a kilogram.
A crucial piece is always off-target editing. Did they check for unintended cuts or changes elsewhere in the genome?
They did, very thoroughly.
Yeah.
Used multiple methods, OneSec, ChangeSecB, modified GuideSec. They even used DNA from the patient's father, who carried the mutation.
Comprehensive approach.
Very. They prioritized 21 potential off-target sites plus the actual target. They found very low-level bystander editing at the normal CPS1 gene site in cells.
Okay.
And one low-level off-target hit in an intron of the ATP7B gene in UH7 cells, but crucially, not in primary human liver cells.
Mm-hmm.
And importantly, ATP7B issues aren't linked to cancer risk.
So no major red flags in primary human cells.
Exactly. In the primary human hepatocytes, across a larger set of potential sites, they didn't detect off-target editing. That provided significant reassurance.
All right, so preclinical data looked promising. Then came the regulatory step for this N of one case.
Yes, they applied for single patient expanded access, an IND, with the FDA when the baby was 6 months old.
And that went quickly, too.
Approved within a week. Speaks volumes about the urgency and the data, because there was a theoretical risk of an immune reaction to the newly made correct CPS1 protein.
Right, the body might see it as foreign.
Precisely. So they started the infant on prophylactic immunosuppressants, sirolimus and tacrolimus, before the treatment. They specifically avoided steroids because those can worsen hyperammonemia.
Smart move. And then the first dose.
At 7 months old, day 208 after birth, the first IV infusion of K at 0.1 milligy kilogram.
What happened clinically after that first dose?
Some positive signs. They were able to slowly increase dietary protein, which is a big deal for these kids.
Huh.
The patient also got through a viral infection without a major ammonia crisis, though they did need some supportive care for a day.
But not a complete fix yet.
Not completely. They couldn't fully wean the baby off the standard ammonia scavenging drug, glycerophenylbutyrate, after just that one dose.
Okay, so a second higher dose was considered.
Correct. About 3 weeks later, they gave a second infusion at 0.3 milligate kilograms. There was a brief coughing spell during the infusion, but it passed quickly.
And after the second dose, any more changes?
Again, those transient liver enzyme bumps were seen, especially during another illness. But the really key outcome was about 2 weeks after that second dose.
Yes.
They could cut the glycerol phenylbutyrate dose in half compared to where they started without problems. And the baby weathered two more viral illnesses with vomiting and diarrhea without an ammonia spike, even while on a full protein diet.
That sounds like a significant clinical improvement in stability.
It really does. A major improvement.
Were there biochemical markers to back this up? Ammonia levels?
Yes. The median blood ammonia levels dropped. Before treatment, median was 23 micromoles per liter. Between doses, it went down to 9. After the second dose, it was around 13. A definite reduction.
Interesting. And what about orotic acid? That's another marker related to the urea cycle, isn't it?
It is. Normally, it's low in CPS1 deficiency because the cycle isn't working properly upstream.
Yeah.
After treatment, urinary orotic acid levels went up.
Went up.
Yes, from a median of 1.7 before treatment towards the higher end of normal, or even slightly above, with a median of 2.4 after treatment. This suggests the CPS1 enzyme was starting to work again, processing carbamoyl phosphate, which then feeds into orotic acid production.
That's quite compelling biochemical evidence and overall development.
The patient gained weight consistently, and neurological status remained stable during the 7-week follow-up reported, all pointing towards a positive effect.
This is genuinely remarkable stuff. Thinking about the bigger picture, what are the main implications here?
Well, the speed is the first thing. 6 months. It proves rapid development of personalized gene editing is feasible. It really opens the door, potentially, for similar approaches for hundreds of other liver-based metabolic disorders.
Like a platform technology.
Exactly. The authors compare it to antisense oligonucleotides, ASOs, where you have the basic delivery tech, like the lipid nanoparticle and the mRNA here, and you just swap out the specific guide RNA for each different mutation or patient.
That could streamline things massively. Of course, there are always other considerations, ethics, long-term safety.
Absolutely. They didn't do a liver biopsy to directly measure editing, deemed too risky for the infant. Germline editing wasn't assessed here. But they cite other work with similar LNP delivery showing no germline effects in animals.
Right.
And a key advantage of LNPs over, say, AAV gene therapy is the potential for redosing if needed, since you don't typically get blocking antibodies.
True. And maybe less reliance on animal models in the future.
That's a hope. Perhaps using patient-derived iPSCs for more of the preclinical testing could become standard. The overall feeling is that this kind of rapid, patient-specific gene therapy might become routine for many genetic diseases down the line.
It certainly feels like a glimpse into the future of personalized medicine. So, if we were to boil down the key results from this study, what are the top takeaways?
Okay, three key results I'd highlight are, one, the clear reduction in median blood ammonia levels post-treatment, indicating improved metabolic control.
Right.
Two, the increase in urinary orotic acid, which strongly suggests at least partial restoration of the CPS1 enzyme's function in the liver.
Mm-hmm.
And three, the documented clinical improvements, better protein tolerance, reduced need for scavenger meds, and stability during illnesses, all while maintaining normal neurological development in that follow-up period.
Excellent summary. These initial findings, while needing longer follow-up, of course, are incredibly promising for a devastating disease.
They absolutely are. A real potential lifeline.
This has been a fascinating deep dive. It really highlights the speed and potential of where gene editing is heading. Thanks for breaking it down with us.
My pleasure. Always exciting to discuss these advancements.
And thank you, our listeners, for joining this critical discussion on Science TLDR. Now, here's something to think about. As these highly personalized N-of-1 therapies become more feasible, what frameworks do we need ethically, logistically, regulatorily to ensure fair access and responsible innovation? How do healthcare systems adapt to treatments designed, potentially, for just one person at a time? Something to consider. We'll see you next time.